From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
We thought of the world as being far too much reliant on either-or, male-female, black-white, good-bad, Christian-Muslim, etc. So we began to look at becoming hermaphrodite.
British conceptual artist Genesis P. Orridge on his efforts to create a new kind of being, the Pandragine. We'll hear more from P. Orridge in this hour as we explore transgender identity. Also, a fictional Turkish detective who is a eunuch.
I think all detectives are sort of eunuchs. I mean, Sherlock Holmes doesn't exactly have a romping sex life himself.
And writer Kelly Eskridge introduces us to her captivating character, Mars, whose gender remains a mystery. But first, a man named Aaron Raz Link, who used to be a girl named Sarah. Raz Link is the co-author, along with his mother, Hilda Raz, of a collaborative memoir called What Becomes You. Here's Aaron Raz Link reading an excerpt from the book.
Are you a boy or a girl? They're second graders. The ones who ask the question always are. What do you think I am? Well, the small faces screw tight, thinking hard. You don't have lipstick. You got short hair. You're wearing pants, and you don't have any makeup, and struggling to articulate the defining characteristics of the type here. You go in the mud and stuff. They look up at me expectantly, confused. There's something else about me, though, something strange. They can't figure out what it is. Neither can I. My question puts off the moment when I have to give them an answer. Once I asked a girl about six what she thought I was. She looked up shyly from her little velvet dress with its matching tights and patent leather shoes. I was wearing my Victorian explorer suit, spotless canvas drill pants, and crisp blonde photographer's vest. I was holding live tarantulas. I was 100 feet tall. She leaned toward me and whispered, I think you're a girl. Her eyes were bright with hope.
Aaron Raz Link reading an excerpt from What Becomes You, the memoir he wrote with his mother, Hilda Raz. The book chronicles Raz Link's former life as a girl named Sarah and his new life as a gay man. Aaron Raz Link and Hilda Raz spoke with Steve Paulson.
I think that the trope that I hear often is men trapped in women's bodies, women trapped in men's bodies. And what I like to say and what I say in the book is it disguises the fact that I have changed and there is only one of me. This is the only body I have ever had. It is my body from birth to death. It looked like a woman's body at one time in a way that seemed perfectly ordinary to everyone. It looks like a man's body now in a way that seems perfectly ordinary to everyone. And I am the same person.
So you're trying to get away from those common definitions of being male or female then?
Well, yes and no. If I was female and I am male, then the stories we tell that say that men and women are different species and we cannot understand each other and we don't react and respond in similar ways and our lives don't have anything to do with each other, well, those stories are not true.
Mm-hmm. And that was hard for me to understand. Aaron would say to me soon after his transition, well, tell me the story about going out into the world to buy hardware. And I would mutter to him, oh, go ask your father. You're his now.
And I would say, what?
He would say, Mom, I'm the same person.
Now, is it fair to say that you struggled with this whole issue of your identity for the first 29 years of your life?
I didn't struggle with my identity. I couldn't understand why everyone was so stupid. They just something wrong with them. I don't know why people thought I was a girl and they thought I was a lesbian and they thought, and boy, people must be really stupid.
Tell the story about your name.
Oh, yeah. Some people, when I was first transitioning, I talked to some people who had transitioned and helped me a lot. And they said, for instance, you should think about changing your name. And I said, what's wrong with my name? I like Sarah. I like Sarah just fine. And they would say, well,
I wish
you could
see Aaron, that, you know, definitely all guy.
I was just determined, you know, I was going to make my way by myself, by Aaron, and everything was going to be just the way I wanted. I don't care what anybody thinks about me. And I was, and you know, this woman would say very gently, well, Sarah is a girl's name. And, well, you know, it could mean rock in Swahili. It doesn't mean I'm a rock. And finally, she lost patience with me, and she said, look, if you want people to know who you are, you might want to give them a clue.
Hmm. Now, was it difficult to make the decision to have surgery?
Once I knew what it looked like, I was, can I be there 5 minutes ago?
Hmm.
When your body does not work, you will go a long, long way to get into a situation where your body works. I have had other disabilities as well for unrelated things, and I've had the experience of standing up and finding that my leg would not hold me. You call the doctor and you go, I can't stand on my foot. What I'll do anything. Just tell me what to do. I'll come in, whatever. We rely on our bodies. They're how we communicate with each other. They're how we know ourselves. Mm-hmm. They're what gets us through the day. If your body isn't working for you, yeah, you'll go way out of your way to get into a situation where it is.
Mm-hmm. So it wasn't helpful really for me to be saying you're a different person now because my child was embodied in a way that I could perceive as changed, but it was still the same body.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a long time to get that through my head.
What did you actually have done? I mean, what happened in the surgery?
Well, I was asleep at the time. The big misconception is that the surgeons somehow control this process and they determine what you're going to look like and they make the decisions. The surgeons actually can't decide on anything. The process is controlled by a psychiatric association. So the psychiatrists and the psychologists and the counselors and the social workers have to sign off on what they think you should be allowed to have. And then you get to choose from among the list of options that's approved by them. But the really big change is actually hormones. Most of what people look like when you walk down the street has to do with your hormone levels, and that's involved in aging as well. It's involved in lots of things. So I was growing a beard before I ever had surgery. I didn't lose my hair until after the surgery. That was a shock. I had my body picked out. I was going to be tall and blonde and beautiful. And now, you know, I look like my cousin's action figure. It's just how your body responds to the hormones. I have male pattern baldness. That's in my genes, but it doesn't appear until your body is experiencing a lot of testosterone. And so I didn't know I had male pattern baldness until I began to take testosterone and bing, my hair fell out.
Hmm.
All of those changes are irreversible, so I would not have any hair regardless. What the surgeon does is take care of those things that hormones don't change in an adult. If you had gotten the hormones in utero, they would change. Testosterone in the womb is what causes male genitalia to look like they do instead of more or less like female genitalia. Surgery takes care of things like that. Surgery takes care of removing the extra skin from the breast area that remains when the fatty tissue reorganizes, and that's all stuff that hormones do. I went through puberty, basically. I mean, that's the essential thing about hormones. You go through puberty, and if you're trans, you go through puberty when you're old enough to know better.
So this was a shock, I presume.
You bet. Sarah and I had discussed over the years almost anything that two people who are comfortable with one another and are used to each other can discuss. but we didn't have a language for sex change because we didn't know it was possible. I had grown accustomed in my thinking about gender to imagine with Judith Butler that gender was enacted on a spectrum. And clearly, Sarah was at the male end of the female spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's worth pointing out that you're a feminist scholar. I mean, you know, you brought a lot to this whole business. I mean,
It didn't do me a bit of good.
I think we all bring a lot to this whole business. One thing that I came to understand going through transition and writing What Becomes You was driven by that for me. We know each other by our bodies. When you walk down the street and you see someone, as a trans friend of mine said, they're going to say, "Hello, sir," or "Hello, ma'am."
And the one irreducible fact about identity in a generation interested in identifying identity in many diverse ways is the irreducible fact of gender. Male or female. The spectrum has at one end female and on the other end male. My older son, John, is male. My younger daughter, Sarah, is female. Well, in our life, we discovered that theory falls away in the face of life.
And that theory is without body, and bodies are our experience of living. So that I discovered all kinds of things I didn't know before. When my body was female, I imagined that masculinity was about pushing forward, about being more aggressive, about being harder and louder. And as I came into a body that was male, I began to discover masculinity was a lot about doing less, moving back, being controlled, because so much has to do with compared to what. We want to be seen as strong, as capable, as powerful, but whether that's compared to helpless or compared to violent and dangerous and unpredictable changes the way that you have to behave and you have to live. What we have is a way to communicate with each other. It's not all in my head. It's not all in your head. It's in the space between us.
Well, it almost sounds like the two of you want to do away with words like male and female, men and women, and yet we can't.
Exactly the reverse.
Oh, really?
Exactly the reverse.
Okay. It is the reverse.
I would like to have as many words as possible. We have bodies. We have minds, we have ideas, we have physical sexes, we have gender in concept. The more words we have available to us to communicate with each other, the better chance we'll get something across. I don't believe in telling people what they should say.
Hilda, was it hard for you to accept Aaron after the surgery?
The short answer is no, but I worked very hard to give up my fantasies about a matriarchal line in which certain kinds of knowledge and certain expectations of progress were handed down from mother to daughter across generations. I held that fantasy firm in my heart, and so I imagined that my daughter would in her life enact a greater agency, a firmer power to alter her life and also the lives of other women. What I came to understand is Aaron as a man, and if you knew him, and if you read the book, I think you do know him, Aaron is as male as any person can ever be, but yet in many important ways he absorbed all of the messages that I was giving my daughter about inheritance. And then the matriarchal line is not matriarchal, but human. I could never have known that fact without our shared experience of his sex change.
And I grew up understanding that each generation hopes to give to the next the benefit of their experience, the benefit of whatever wisdom we accumulate, and you hope that the next generation will carry that on into some life which is easier and better and stronger. And I felt so intensely that that was what I wanted to do and that that was the charge of my life was to carry forward. And it never once occurred to me that this had anything to do with being a woman.
Aaron Raz Link and his mother Hilda Raz are the co-authors of the collaborative memoir What Becomes You. They spoke with Steve Paulson. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, British conceptual artist Genesis P. Orridge on his efforts to modify his body to create a new kind of being as we continue our look at transgender identity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Genesis P. Orridge describes himself as a cultural engineer. The British conceptual artist is probably best known for his work in the mid-70s with Throbbing Gristle, a band that pioneered industrial music. P. Orridge's latest project finds him reinventing himself, quite literally, as a pandrogyne, or hermaphrodite by choice, as P. Orridge has described it. To the Best of Our Knowledge, producer Doug Gordon explains.
In 1993, Genesis P. Orridge met and married Jacqueline Breyer. She took the name Lady J. Breyer P. Orridge. While it's often said that married couples become more alike over the years, Genesis P. Orridge and Lady J. Breyer P. Orridge became more alike, literally. Over the last several years, they've had several cosmetic surgeries to become more like each other. It's what the couple calls pandrogyny, which is short for positive androgyny, perfect androgyny, and possible androgyny. Genesis P. Orridge says that the couple wanted to rebel against the DNA of their bodies.
We started to look at DNA and think of it as a long recording, almost like a film. And each person has a package of DNA that they receive at birth. And normally, the way they biologically unfold and grow and develop a shape and a face is completely a result of the DNA program. It's not something that's particularly chosen. So we wondered if that was in fact key to learning ways to change human behavior, because we tend to behave as we're expected, and the way we look is part of that expectation. So we began to really focus on confounding DNA as a matter of principle to see if we could change the future.
Could this really be me? Could this really be me in the body? In the body.
That's a song called In the Body from the new album Hell is Invisible, Heaven is Her, or Hell is Invisible, Heaven is Here. It's the new album by Genesis P. Orridge's current band, Psychic TV. The theme of pandrogyny recurs throughout the album. There's a slogan that P. Orridge likes to use to describe the pandrogyny project.
Viva la evolution. Basically saying the human species must take responsibility for its own evolution. It must start to consider consciousness and the mind and ethics and potential. Put as much into that and think about that just as much as it does machinery, weaponry, defense, and all those other things that money is wasted on.
Genesis P. Orridge doesn't want to be referred to as he anymore. I'm to refer to P. Orridge as she or Shahi. I asked P. Orridge what Shahi has done to confound her DNA.
the first thing was that I got a vasectomy because we wanted to propose that replication was in a way a surrender to a biological program that wasn't chosen. After that, we thought we would like to take things further and imagine a world that was no longer binary. We thought of the world as being far too much reliant on either or, male, female, black, white, good, bad, Christian, Muslim, etc. So we began to look at becoming a hermaphrodite, the two of us, myself and my partner, Lady J, who I've been with for 14 years. So on Valentine's Day 2003, we both went to a friendly cosmetic surgeon in New York City and both got breast implants the same day, the same size, together, and woke up next to each other holding hands afterwards. The first thing I said was, I looked down and I said to Lady J, "Look, it's our angelic body." So we began to actually deliberately blur our physical identity. Since then, we've tried to look more and more like each other, to become one being in two halves. So Lady J has had eye surgeries to make her eyes more like mine, a chin implant, various other facial procedures. I've had cheek implants. My face shape has been changed. I had liposuction, although since then I've lost so much weight it was a waste of money. In prehistoric times, human beings had to survive in a very dangerous, very primitive environment. And so it was necessary for the male of the species to be very aggressive, to attack things that were outside that seemed threatening, to be suspicious and violent towards anything other, anything different, because no one understood the greater part of the world. They tried to protect the women and the children to maintain the population. They also were violent in order to protect food supply. So that violence and that fear of difference and fear of the other was very successful for our survival in prehistoric times. Now we've, on our own, through our cleverness, we've created this amazing futuristic 21st century science fiction environment, but our behavior hasn't changed at all. We're still behaving in prehistoric ways, but we've got these tools from the future, and that's a recipe for disaster. We haven't bothered to apply ourselves to evolve equally with the tools that we create.
So by becoming more like each other, did Peurich and Lady J. Breyer Peurich hold themselves up as models for redefining gender and gender relations?
Gender and gender relations is part of it, but that's symptomatic of the greater issue, which is the basic behavioral pattern that gets human beings to attack anyone else who's different, who proposes different ways of living or being, who has different ways of seeing the world, who has different solutions to problems that occur. That basic program is going to destroy us at the moment. You can see it all over the world, the polarization, the return to primitive responses on a large scale by governments and groups of people. So it's a very, very important issue. But we would like to take it even further. We think that not just catching up with what we have now is important, but if we want to actually evolve as a species, we mustn't think of the human body as sacred or special. It's simply raw material that makes us able to carry our consciousness around. It just gives the brain mobility. That's all it does. And it sort of feeds it, of course, too. But basically, it's just there to maintain the brain and consciousness. If we want to go into space, for example, it would be fantastic to learn how to hibernate, like bears do. We might be better off in space or at the Arctic Circle if we were cold-blooded. We might need to have scales in order to avoid the problems of the ozone layer being disintegrated. We're basically saying that the human body should be seen merely as a container for consciousness, and we should use it as a machine and redesign it to suit whatever purpose we have.
Unfortunately, Lady J. Brier Peorage passed away shortly after I spoke to Genesis Peorage. Lady J. died from a previously undiagnosed heart condition, which is thought to have been connected with a long battle with stomach cancer. Genesis Peorage has two daughters from a previous relationship. I was curious to know what they thought of Peorage's body modifications.
To be fair, they've both been absolutely incredible. We go out and they're completely unfazed. Not at all awkward. They introduced me to their friends. Here's my dad. I went out for dinner with Jeanette and two of her friends just a few weeks ago. We all had a nice dinner in a restaurant. And if anything, I think her friends were more relaxed because they sort of included me in their girly talk. Almost just naturally, they saw me as being part of their group, you know, their particular little clique. So in a certain ways, they've become closer to me because there's none of that usual awkwardness about the other species. You know, male are another species to female and vice versa. So they've been good. The only thing that was negative was that Jeanette, when I first told her, I spoke to her on the phone a few days later, and she said, "You mean you spent all that money on getting breasts when you could have bought me a new car?"
I was afraid that I would be made to try and be a person that I didn't learn to want. Oh, how I cried when I looked inside and saw someone else that's not myself. I say, I don't think so.
It's a song called I Don't Think So from Psychic TV's new album. British conceptual artist Genesis Peorage is the leader of Psychic TV. Peorage spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. What are your thoughts on gender and gender identity? You can share them with us by sending email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we'll look at how gender is portrayed in the mystery fiction of Jason Goodwin and the speculative fiction of Kelly Eskridge as we conclude our hour on transgender identity. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
People saw him, but they didn't quite notice him either. And it was this absence of hard edges, this peculiar withdrawal of challenge or threat, that comprised his essential talent and made him, even in 19th century Istanbul, unique. Yashim did not challenge the men who met him, or the women. With his kind face, grey eyes, dark curls, barely touched at 40 by the passage of the years, Yashim was a listener, a quiet questioner, and not entirely a man. Yashim was a eunuch.
Jason Goodwin reading an excerpt from his new mystery novel, The Snake Stone. It's the second novel to feature the Turkish eunuch detective, Yashim Togalu, set in early 19th century Istanbul. Goodwin talked to Anne Strangeshamps about his character, Yashim.
Yashim is, fundamentally, he's a good man. But, of course, then we have this, you know, is he a man? He sees himself as a sort of servant of the people. He's in Istanbul, it's the 1830s. I think his backstory, which I've sort of pondered and developed, he comes from the sort of Black Sea region of what's now Turkey, which is then the Ottoman Empire. And he has made his way to Istanbul. At some point, he became a eunuch, or was made a eunuch.
Do you know how that happened?
Yeah, I do, but I'm...
not, and will you not, tell us?
No. This one can run and run. It's a sort of... I know what happened, and I think each book is going to reveal a little bit more of how this terrible thing befell him. It happened to him when he was about sort of 16, 17. That I know. So he wasn't like the majority of eunuchs who were eunucized when they were pre-pubertal, which makes him slightly different because, of course, he's a fictional character and I don't want him speaking in a high, squeaky voice.
How common was this? We're talking about the Ottoman Empire and that makes one think of sultans and harems. And many of us may remember that sultans often had eunuchs guarding the harems. But this is 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
How common were eunuchs still?
We have to get back to what the sort of function of a eunuch was and where he stood in the whole sort of hierarchy of Ottoman family life, if you like. So a lot of grand families would have eunuch servants working for them. And their function really was to act as go-betweens between the harem, which, you know, we all think of the harem being a sort of lascivious place of sort of women and sex and the sort of kind of the sultan coming in. I mean, the harem is actually just the home space of the family. It's where the, in this case, it would be the sultan and his wives and then maybe his concubines, but also his servants and children. And there was a much broader sense of family, I think, in those traditional societies generally, but the Ottomans in particular. So there'd be this large family group and they would live in the harem. They would be, as it were, behind these walls. They wouldn't go out in public, wouldn't be sort of exposed to the sort of public realm. And the eunuchs were certainly in the sultan's family, but also in the family of other sort of high dignitaries in the Ottoman Empire. They would be there to be go-betweens between the sort of outside public realm and the private family world.
Why were they made eunuchs in the first place? Why was it considered valuable that they be eunuchs?
I mean, people have been making eunuchs for thousands of years. And I mean, if you go right back to, I don't know, the time of Alexander and earlier, I mean, sort of the Persian empires, you find that there were eunuch servants and notables in courts, in Eastern courts and Middle Eastern courts. And there was a kind of need or perceived need to create a third sex. And I think the reason, essentially the reason why people or rulers wanted to have eunuchs in their court was that because the eunuch can't create his own family, he has to identify that much more strongly with the ruler's family. He can't break away. He's not going to found his own dynasty and then start working towards advancing his children's careers at the expense of the ruler he serves.
So it's more about creating an extremely loyal servant than it is about creating a man who will not seduce your wives?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's that was probably sort of a valuable byproduct. But I think essentially it was about the perfect servant. I think that was the object. I mean, it was obviously, you know, it was done as, I mean, originally it was also done as punishment and so on. It wasn't something anyone probably went into willingly. But I think a eunuch was viewed as being, certainly in the Byzantine times, was viewed as being the perfect servant. And what's very interesting, really, is that I think all empires in the sort of medieval and earlier periods have used eunuchs. And that includes the Chinese, Mughal India, and the empires of the Middle East. The only place you don't find eunuchs, in the medieval world anyway, is in Western Europe. But then in Western Europe, they had a celibate clergy. So, you know, a Catholic priest doesn't marry and monks don't marry. Therefore, they were used, in fact, in the sort of chanceries of the king. And they were the sort of first civil servants, if you like.
It's interesting that you chose to make your detective a eunuch. What about being a eunuch do you think might enhance Yashim's detective skills?
Well, I think there were sort of three reasons why it was good to make him a eunuch. And one is quite simply a sort of in this traditional world, Yashim is able to move through the city. He can go wherever he wants. He can go into the harem of, you know, other men's harems. He can talk to women without presenting a threat or a challenge. So he can actually sort of, he can do those things. So that makes him, it's good for a detective. He can get where he wants to go. And that's one reason. And I guess another is that I think all detectives, I mean, all detectives are sort of eunuchs. A lot of the famous detectives are I mean, Sherlock Holmes doesn't exactly have a romping sex life himself. Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's detective, they have this sort of detachment from society, and I think that's quite important in a detective, in a fiction detective.
Yeah, they're often outsiders in some way or another. I was thinking of Miss Marple, Agatha Christie's detective, who looks like an innocent old lady with her knitting, but who is actually a remarkably shrewd observer of human nature.
Exactly.
Maybe the outsider status is necessary to give somebody the ability to both to pass undetected and unremarked and also to observe.
Exactly, and I think that certainly in a fictional detective, you need somebody who can observe from the outside, who can be looking at this, as it were, the sort of human comedy that's presented to him or her, and begin to sift it through and to feel in a sort of dispassionate way, feel their way through. I mean, they have to have this detachment. And certainly in Yashim's case, he can go where he wants. He has this slightly sort of quizzical, tangential view of the world that he's working in. And then I quite like the thought that he, because he's a eunuch, because he's not, as it were, either challenging the men or the women, don't quite notice him when he is around, so that he can, he's allowed to observe things which perhaps he wouldn't otherwise be able to.
Does he himself see himself as not quite a man, as a member of a third sex?
I think he feels, I think that for him, becoming a eunuch was something that in many ways, it's every man's worst nightmare, isn't it? It's famously. And so I'm trying to think, how would he come to terms with that? He's made a eunuch. And how would he recover from that? What I find interesting about him as a character is, how did he come back from, as it were, the dead to become this sort of gentle and helpful good man? How do you become a good man after something as sort of kind of terrifying and scarifying as that had occurred to you? And
how do you?
Well, I think you go to a very, very, you go to this terrible, dark place. And for him, I think the way out was to realize that many of the things which one would take for granted in the future, one's hope for a family and so on, he could no longer hope for. So his idea became first that he would get into a terrible, bitter state, anger and fury and jealousy of, as it were, people who were able to enjoy those sort of pleasures and ambitions. But then you can't live in that. You can't, can you? I mean, you can't live hating the world. You can't exist feeling bitter. So he has to overcome that by dedicating himself to the sort of service of the people. He has to see that he's been given something which does, in fact, make him unique and makes him stand out, that he can't enjoy this kind of great human comedy directly, but he can observe it and he can try and help people make their way through it. I think that's what I like about him, is that he's a good man who wants to help. And I think the desire to help is born out of, is part of his, as it were, his recovery process.
Jason Goodwin is the author of two mystery novels featuring the Turkish eunuch detective Yashim, the Edgar Award-winning The Janissary Tree, and its sequel, The Snake Stone. Goodwin spoke to Anne Strangehamps. Kelly Eskridge is a fiction writer, essayist, and screenwriter. Eskridge describes her work as speculative fiction that is character-driven. Her new collection of short stories is called Dangerous Space. Three of the stories feature a compelling character named Mars, whose gender remains a mystery.
Mars is a character who does, in fact, appear in three different stories. The stories themselves are not related in time or space or context, but I like to think of them as being related thematically. In two of the stories, Mars is an adult character, and in one story, Mars is adolescent. But to me, there's a continuity of spirit, a continuity of character, a continuity of a way of looking at and engaging with the world that makes Mars the same character to me.
One of the things you're being very careful not to do is to identify any gender for Mars.
That's true. There are no gender identifiers at all in the stories attached to Mars, although people around Mars are identified as he, she.
Why did you do that? Why did you decide? I mean, that's in some ways the defining characteristic of Mars, is that Mars is not gender identified.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I did that because, for me, Mars is a character, a human being that I hope that any reader can access. One of the things that happens when a writer genders a character in fiction is that readers bring certain expectations to that character. We are in some ways so constrained by cultural notions of gender that we assume, if we know a character is a woman, well, she's going to do this, but she probably won't do that because women generally don't. And the same thing for men. And we find ourselves as readers often judging characters negatively or positively because they react in gendered or non-gendered ways to their surroundings.
You're perfectly willing to make other characters in these stories gender-based. There are males and females, and there's no hesitation. So the reader comes to those characters with those expectations. Does some of that bleed off into our expectations of Mars?
I think that we can't help but bring assumptions to reading, but I think that readers look for ways to identify with characters in stories. Certainly, that's the point for me of writing character-driven fiction, is to provide a different life, a new space for a reader to walk around and to see the world through different eyes and experience it in different ways. And one of the things that I hope with Mars is that anyone can step into Mars' skin and experience the world in ways that, no matter whether you come to Mars as a woman, a man, gay, straight, bisexual, whatever the particular assumptions you bring to the character, at some point the character will do something that's going to challenge those assumptions. If you read Mars as a woman, at some point she will do something that surprises you. If you read Mars as a man, that's equally true.
Well, let's explore Mars a little bit. The first story in this collection that Mars is featured in is called And Salome Danced. Can you tell us what's the story about?
The story takes place in the world of theater, and Mars is a theater director rehearsing a play called Salome. During the audition process, a man named Joe comes in to read for the part of John the Baptist. And the next day, the same person returns as a woman named Joe to read for Salome. And she's very good. Mars casts her in the role. But while everyone else thinks that Joe is a cross-dressing genius, Mars understands that Joe was a man when he came in and was a woman when she came back, and that something deeply unsettling and intriguing is happening. And the story is about what happens.
There's a little section when Mars begins to understand how deeply Joe, whether it's Joe with an E or Joe without, can get inside not only the character that is on stage, but the people off stage. Would you read a little bit for us?
Sure. I'll read a little bit that takes place as the cast of the show is relaxing and arguing about whether a woman could be cast as Judas in the play Jesus Christ Superstar. "What do you think, Mars?" The voice is Joe's, and it startles me. I've been enjoying the conversation so much that I've forgotten the danger in relaxing around Joe or anything that interests her. I look at her now, still sprawled against the platform with an inch of golden beer in the bottle beside her. She's been enjoying herself, too. I'm not sure where this is going, what the safe answer is. I remember saying to Lucky, gender's not important. Gender's not important, isn't that right, Mars? Joe goes on. Lucky told her about it, I think, but I know that Lucky didn't. She didn't have to. That's right, I say, and I know from Joe's smile that my voice is not as controlled as it should be. Even so, I'm not prepared for what happens next. A jumble of pictures in my head. Images of dancing in a place so dark that I can't tell if I'm moving with women or men. images of streets filled with androgynous people and people whose gender blurring surpasses androgyny and leaps into the realm of performance. Women dressed as men making love to men. Men dressed as women hesitating in front of public bathroom doors. Women in high heels and pearls with biceps so large that they split the expensive silk shirts. And the central image, the real point, Joe, naked, obviously female, slick with sweat, moving under me and over me, Joe making love to me until I gasp, and then she begins to change until it is the other Joe with me, the man on me, and I open my mouth to shout my absolute instinctive refusal, and I remember Lucky saying, it's important if you might want to sleep with it, and the movie breaks in my head, and I'm back with the others. No one has noticed that I've been assaulted, turned inside out. They're still talking about the play. Just imagine the difference in all the relationships if Judas were a woman, one of them says earnestly. It would change everything. Joe smiles at me and swallows the last of her beer.
Wow. It's not just the gender that isn't clear about Joe, is it?
No, no. This is a story that was actually sold as a horror story. And I think there is a certain horror in finding out that something that compels us so is not at all what we thought it was and is far more dangerous than we knew.
And maybe trying to assign roles to the characters we come across, whether on the page or in real life, is part of the problem, I guess.
I think it is part of the problem. And the reason that I created Mars the way I did was not to play a game with the reader, was not to demonstrate my cleverness as a writer. It's not about that. It's about my passionate conviction that the human heart is the human heart, and that issues of biology and issues of gender don't constrain human beings from feeling what the human heart feels or from having any human experience. I am so impatient with the expectations that many readers put on characters specifically because of gender. Well, you know, a woman wouldn't really do that. Or, well, you know, he seems awfully soft for a man. That kind of thing infuriates me because I believe that any human emotion, any human experience is available to all of us. And the idea of norming experience specifically based on biology, of taking gender and elevating it to the notions of gender and elevating them to the status of fact, as if suddenly women can't do something or men can't do something. And it's not even so much that we're incapable, but also that we are not allowed, that it's somehow transgressive to be ourselves in the world. And I think that's an astonishing thing to do to people. I don't like it. And writing about Mars is my way of trying to open to the reader and say, look, this is a human experience. Come in and have the human experience. And if you are willing to walk in this character's shoes, understand that whatever this character might do is a human thing, and you could do it too.
But of course, everybody who comes to the story does bring those expectations. We've been trained to bring those expectations
Absolutely.
To the stories. I'm curious, I guess, what reaction people have had when they come. Do most people come away from that story with the feeling that they know what gender Mars is?
Yes, most people don't actually notice that gender hasn't been assigned. Most people do not take it up as a question. I've seen Mars reviewed as both male and female unquestioningly. Simply, Mars is a man who, Mars is a woman who, and going on to recount the story and then to comment upon the story.
Must bring a smile to your face.
It yes and no, it does, absolutely. But at the same time, I would love for more readers to have the experience of reading Mars that I have when I write Mars, which is this absolute sense of freedom to imagine the character as male, as female, and to therefore, depending on who Mars is interacting with, responding to sexually, to imagine Mars as gay or straight or bisexual, and to really come away with an understanding that of course this could happen if Mars were a man, and of course this could happen if Mars were a woman, and that there doesn't have to be a discontinuity in having a character who in the same story weeps and hits someone in a bar fight.
Do you find yourself coming to this story with different ideas of who Mars is? I mean, when you go back through this, whether you read it on the page or whether you imagine the story in your mind, does Mars' gender shift?
Not really. Mars to me is a mask that I wear, not a mask exactly, but a skin that I put on to write about. And when I write about Mars, I have some of the purest access to my own writing well, to all the stuff that's deep within me, to where I live as an artist and a writer and as a human person. I feel like I have so much more access to that in some way because it doesn't matter whether Mars is male or female. Wherever the character's going emotionally, I can go to. And I don't have to justify or explain within the context of the ordinary world. I'll give you an example of why this is important to me. I had dinner with friends a while back, and just before the release of the collection, and was describing to one of my friends who hadn't read the stories what the Mars stories were and why they were so interesting to me as a writer. And my friend said, well, so you never say whether Mars is a man or a woman, and the other characters in the story don't relate to Mars specifically as a man or a woman, and how can you do that? Because gender is the most important thing about us. It's the first question we ask when someone has a baby. Is it a boy or a girl? That's how we define each other. How can you possibly imagine that you could write a whole story about someone and not point us in that direction and not tell us who they are? And I finally got a little impatient and said, this is speculative fiction. I can do whatever I want.
Kelly Eskridge's new short story collection is called Dangerous Space. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 12-2B, Transgender Identity. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.